Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're happy to have Larry Wittner on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, Confronting the Bomb, A Short History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement. I remember back in my college days, I participated in something called a die-in, and this was organized by a nuclear disarmament group on campus. I believe it was about 1983, and they set up white crosses all over the college green, and we laid down as if we were dead. I'm not really quite sure what I thought of this at the time. I suppose I thought it was in a good cause. I did not, however, think that it would really do anything to bring nuclear disarmament. It turns out I was wrong, as Larry shows in this book. He demonstrates that the nuclear disarmament movement, from its origins before the point there was a bomb to the present, has actually moved policy not only here, but also in places like the Soviet Union and France and in Britain, Japan, and among the other what we used to call great powers. I was surprised to learn this, and I was heartened to learn this actually as well. I enjoyed talking to Larry today, and I think that you'll enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Larry.
Hi there, Marshall.
How are you today?
Fine, fine.
Good. How
are things out there?
In Iowa, they're actually beautiful today. You know, we have great falls here. You're in New York, is that correct?
Yes, yes, Albany, New York.
Uh-huh. Has the fall started?
Well, it has, and it looks a little rainy at this point.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I know you guys have absolutely beautiful falls there with the leaves changing and everything. I lived in that neck of the woods for a little while. I should tell our listeners that we're talking to Larry Wittner today, and we'll be discussing his really interesting new book, Confronting the Bomb, A Short History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement. It's just come out from Stanford University Press. As I was telling Larry in the pre-interview, that, of course, I read these books in preparation for the interviews, and this one I really couldn't put down last night because there was a moment in which I saw my own history in it, and to have the background filled in that way by Larry was very exciting for me. So I'm a little bit sleep-deprived as a result of that, but I'm excited to talk to Larry today, and I hope that all the listeners will be interested to listen to him. Larry, let me begin by asking you to lay out your life, to tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became a historian.
Well, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and I attended Columbia College for my bachelor's degree, University of Wisconsin for my master's, and went back to Columbia University for my PhD, all in history. And so right from the start, I was very interested in the background to the human experience and how things developed as they did over time. But I think that I was also part of many of the key events. I grew up during the years that I eventually studied. And so that gave me a particularly close relationship to historical developments.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get interested in the disarmament movement? And I should tell our listeners, if they don't already know, that you're the author of, I think we can call the foundational three-volume study of this movement, and this book is a distillation of that. How did you come to write about this particular topic?
Well, I've wondered about that myself many times. I think a number of factors explain it. For one thing, I was a child growing up during the Cold War, taking part in nuclear bomb test drills, ducking under my desk when I was told to take cover during grade school and junior high school, given a metal dog tag to wear. This was given out in the New York City public schools with my name and address on it. And when I asked why they were giving us this metal dog tag, I was told that was to identify our bodies in case of a nuclear war, so if somebody could tell our parents that we had died here or there. So the reality of the nuclear arms race became very clear to me. And during my college days, there was a major debate over nuclear testing. And finally, a partial test ban treaty was put into place in 1963. And I remembered that well, in that I was a critic of the resumption of nuclear testing on the part of the United States and the Soviet Union. So I think all those things fed into my sense that the world teetered on the brink of nuclear disaster, as in fact it did. That informed my decision to write about the movement that opposed the nuclear arms race and sought to avert a nuclear war.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that your involvement, and I don't know the extent of it, in the nuclear disarmament movement, or your feelings about it, let me put it that way, did they affect your historical scholarship at all?
Well, sometimes people assume that because I was a critic of nuclear weapons, and indeed I took part in a protest demonstration, the first I ever took part in, I guess it was the fall of 1961 when I was a college senior. Because I was involved in that, protesting against the resumption of nuclear testing, that I must have reached certain conclusions. But in fact, that's not the case. I was interested in the subject. But actually, I began my study, which became that trilogy, The Struggle Against the Bomb. I began that study with the assumption that the movement had no effect on the nuclear arms race or on the willingness of the great powers to wage nuclear war. And as I dug into the files, what I began to find was that the movement did have an effect on the nuclear arms race, that it helped to restrain policymakers in terms of their nuclear ambitions. So, in fact, rather than my ideas being predetermined by my role, marginal as it was, in protest against the nuclear arms race, I later changed my views, the result was a book which outlined something quite different than my earlier assumptions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, that's a terrific experience for a historian to have. I was blessed to have it myself in the first book that I wrote. I went in thinking X, and I came out with Y, and it was a mind-bending and wonderful experience in my case, and I'm sure it was in yours as well.
Right.
Why don't we? It's always nice to learn something.
Right.
It's always nice to learn something. So why don't we just launch into a discussion of the book itself? And I should say,
sure.
I was talking to my wife this morning about this book, and you know, I teach a class on modern warfare from 1500 to the present, and I thought, you know, I have them read all these books about weapons and warfare. I said, maybe I'll have them read this book as well. And it really is apropos.
And she said,
you know, you're absolutely right. They should read this book as well. Because, I mean, as you say, this was a disarmament movement that actually did have an effect. I mean, it is kind of a counterintuitive
absolutely.
Thing. But, you know, in a class about modern warfare, this is completely apropos. So I think you just sold 40 copies, Larry.
Very good.
All right. So anyway, why don't we talk about the history of the disarmament movement itself? It began before there was even a bomb.
That's right. For decades, actually starting in the early 20th century, there was an assumption on the part of some scientists and writers that an atomic bomb could be built. The very popular novelist H.G. Wells wrote a book called The World Set Free that described the war fought with atomic bombs. It was published just at the outset of the First World War, and this science fiction work, as it was viewed, set in the 1950s, by that point, Wells predicted there would be atomic bombs and this world war would be fought with them, and it would be so devastating that national leaders and the public would realize that warfare had simply gone too far, and therefore it was time to get together and bring it to an end. And so world government was formed, and using science and reason, humanity had progressed to a new level of civilization. Well, of course, that didn't take place, but in fact the idea of an atomic bomb was on the minds of scientists and readers of Wells's book. And so one such reader was the physicist, the Hungarian physicist, Leo Szilard. And Szilard was toying with this idea of an atomic bomb, crossing the street in downtown London, when it suddenly occurred to him how there might be a chain reaction and a nuclear explosion could take place. And he was so worried about this happening, since he didn't want it to happen, that he had the idea patented by the British Admiralty. And he subsequently sought to restrain scientists in their nuclear fission research. Unfortunately, this didn't move forward very well, since scientists were used to publicizing their research, as historians are too. And so the nuclear arms race moved forward. The Germans began an atomic bomb project under the Nazi regime. And Szilard, who had moved to the United States by this point, contacted his old mentor, Albert Einstein. And Einstein wrote to President Roosevelt. And of course, people know that was the famous letter that triggered the U.S. Manhattan Project, the atomic bomb project that finally did develop the atomic bomb and led to its use. Now, Szilard and others were very worried about the bomb's use, and the reason they had warned Roosevelt was that they wanted this to be a deterrent to German atomic war. They didn't want the bomb used against countries that didn't have atomic weapons as an act of aggression. And therefore, once they realized that the Germans had surrendered and that the bomb program was moving forward, they sought to stop the bomb from being used. And so here was the genesis of the anti-nuclear movement, ironically begun by people who were actually themselves working on the atomic bomb, like Szilard, for example.
Mm-hmm. And what did they do in order to impress upon the president and then later Truman that the bomb should not be used? What kind of arguments did they muster?
Well, the most famous of the reports by the scientists sent to the Secretary of Defense, and that was supposed to be passed on to the president, was the Frank Report, named after James Frank, who was a German refugee chemist who had fled to the United States, and like Szilard, was working at the Chicago Metallurgical Lab. And the report they drew up on the atomic bomb and its consequences concluded that the use of the bomb by the United States in the war would shock world opinion, would lead to the moral condemnation of the United States, and would in the future make the United States less secure, since other nations would move forward and develop their own atomic weapons. And this report, of course, had no significant impact on the U.S. government. It was delivered within channels. It was not publicized. The bomb project was supposed to be secret, and the scientists respected that secrecy. But, of course, once the bomb was used and the public knew, then the scientists could begin to go to the public and begin this mass public movement against nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm. How did what did the scientists propose to do with the bomb, if not use it or keep it in the arsenal of the United States?
Well, they recommended a demonstration, for example, of its effectiveness, its devastating power. And they thought that Japanese officials might respect that that demonstration. Unfortunately, no demonstration was ever planned or even seriously considered by the U.S. government. Indeed, one of the striking things that one finds when one looks at U.S. government plans for use of the bomb is that government officials were planning how to use it, not asking whether or not the bomb should be used. So they gave very little consideration to whether or not the bomb should be used.
Mm-hmm. Did they want to put it under international control? Do I remember this correctly?
Yes. They recognized, of course, that the bomb could be built since they were building it. although that was in question when they began. That is, they began the bomb project in many cases hoping that the bomb couldn't be built, and therefore there was no danger of an atomic attack by Nazi Germany. But once they recognized the bomb could be built, they began to consider what should be done, not only in terms of its use during the war, but for the future, after the war. Leading physicists who were not originally part of the bomb project, such as the Danish physicist Niels Bohr, who came to the United States, escaped from Denmark to Britain during the war, and came to the United States and actually met with President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill and so on during the war, he urged international control of nuclear weapons, what we might call atomic arms controls. And he felt that short of that, there would be an arms race, and the adaptation of atomic bombs to war. And since war had always been fought in the past, there was a great danger that the next war would, in fact, destroy the world. So the atomic scientists began to rally around this notion of atomic arms controls, later called nuclear arms controls, and to say to governments that it might seem to you that you're safer by building the atomic bomb, but actually, since other governments are doing the same thing, we would all be much safer if this was brought under international control and nations banned from the development and use of nuclear weapons. And this idea was finally taken up by the Truman administration when it proposed the Baruch Plan in the aftermath of the World War.
Mm-hmm. And where did it go?
Well, unfortunately, it didn't go very far. Before the Baruch Plan, the Acheson-Lilienthal Plan, which is really inspired by the ideas of the scientists, was more far-reaching. But the Baruch Plan, finally adopted by the Truman administration, provided for international control of nuclear weapons. They would be placed under the United Nations control and seal, and there would be a series of stages in which in which nations move toward inspection and control procedures, and the stockpile of bombs held by the United States at that point. No other country had nuclear weapons. But those stockpiles of bombs would be gradually placed under UN control. This was a plan that was to the benefit of the United States to some extent, because it meant that other countries would be blocked along the way during this period of so many years of developing the international control system. Other nations would be blocked from developing nuclear weapons, while the United States, at least for the time being, would retain its nuclear stockpile. So this meant that the U.S. government would maintain a nuclear monopoly, and indeed, at any point along the way, could simply pull out of this control system until it was finally fully in place. The Soviet government was very worried about that sort of thing, because it meant that the U.S. government which was on increasingly bad terms with it during the Cold War, would retain its monopoly and the Soviet Union couldn't develop the bomb. Therefore, the Soviets said, why don't we just destroy all nuclear weapons right away? And, of course, the United States didn't want to do that because it had nuclear weapons. And as Truman said, he didn't want to put the U.S. gun down until he was sure that no other country had the gun. And therefore, there was no compromise. The Soviet Union vetoed the idea in the Security Council, Baruch plan. The United States brought it back there once more. The Soviets were against it, but they deliberately stalled. And meanwhile, of course, their solution was to develop their own nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. They felt that from that standpoint, they were much safer. Although I should note that along the way toward their acquisition of the bomb in 1949, the Soviet government was very worried about atomic war. That is, very worried that the U.S. government would unleash atomic war against the Soviet Union, while the United States had atomic bombs and the Soviet Union didn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. One of the things that is eye-opening in your book is the, despite the seemingly conciliatory motions of the Baruch plan and so on and so forth, was the enthusiasm that political leaders had for this weapon.
Right.
The quotations from Churchill are particularly chilling, at least for me, because for those who don't remember, he was a big proponent, oddly enough, of international government after the war. He felt that international government could kind of end war, but he loved the bomb. He thought it was a terrific thing, and that the English should get it as quickly as possible. So how do we explain these? I mean, why this enthusiasm for this weapon? Did they not understand that it really wasn't going to be terribly useful, or did they actually think they were going to use it?
Well, I think they believed they could use it, and in fact, as soon as they had it, they did use it, right? The U.S. government, as soon as it had nuclear weapons ready, and it only had two at the time, in August of 1945, the U.S. government used those two atomic bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And while there was growing protest among the scientists against use of the bomb, from the standpoint of government officials, this was a great new weapon that would add to their weapons arsenals and would help them win wars and maintain national influence in world affairs. But let me just talk more broadly about this question, because I think it's really at the heart of the difficulties that critics of nuclear weapons faced. For thousands of years, competing territories, people in Cave A and people in Cave B were fighting conflicts, were engaged in conflicts against one another over who killed the bear or who deserved the bear meat and so on, and they armed themselves with clubs, and they would fight against one another, and they would stake out their territory and warn foreigners and others to stay out and so on, and this atmosphere of conflict among rival territorial jurisdictions, it continued as their developed nation states, and the nation states fought wars, moving on beyond the early clubs and spears to bows and arrows and guns and machine guns and cannons and battleships and fighter planes and bombers and so on. So it was always assumed that one's own country, one's own patria, needed weapons to defend it, and indeed to secure its interests against all these other competing and potentially hostile territories and then nations. So that when government officials during the Second World War and even after the war had to contend with the scientists and later other critics of the bomb, who told them, no, you know, having more devastating weapons will make you less safe rather than more safe, this seemed counterintuitive. They had several thousand years of experience telling them the bigger and better weapons we have, the safer we are. And so, of course, they just moved these weapons automatically into their national defense plans and later into their wars. And that's what was done in the Second World War. And that's what government officials were tempted to do after the war. And what I suggest in the trilogy, The Struggle Against the Bomb, and in this abbreviated version, Confronting the Bomb, is that it was only popular protest against that notion, protest that said atomic bombs are making the world less safe and more dangerous and will destroy the world if used. It was only that kind of protest that pushed back government officials from their traditional way of thinking and brought about a new way of thinking in world affairs.
Yeah. You bring up some very good points there about human psychology in general, and I think evolutionary psychology. When you were talking, you were reminding me of the way Americans initially reacted to the housing crisis. And that was a remarkable instance of not believing and really just denying what they were seeing, because everyone knows that if you buy a house, it's going to increase in value. That always happens.
Right.
Until it doesn't. And then you can't believe it, so you act as if it isn't happening. And it really
right.
is this sort of humans just love routine. We're just wedded to it. We want things to be the same. And I think in this case, having a weapon that really couldn't be used as a weapon was, as you say, so counterintuitive that it was hard to wrap our minds around it and adjust our behaviors in a rational way. I should tell people who haven't read the book, and I hope everyone does, that the quotations from world leaders about the bomb, and this would include even people that we greatly respect like Eisenhower, are just totally chilling. They talk
right.
about it like it's a big artillery shell, you know.
Right. Eisenhower said, my administration looks at the atomic bomb and the hydrogen bomb, which he was developing at the time in the U.S. arsenal, looks on nuclear weapons as no different than a bullet or anything else used in war.
Yeah.
And that's the old way of thinking, of course, simply integrating nuclear weapons into the old game of war. And that's what the critics of the bomb were protesting against.
They
said, this is not like a bullet or anything else. This is much more dangerous, and this sounds the death knell for humanity, and
yeah.
we have to begin thinking about warfare, and particularly about nuclear warfare, in a new way.
I was reading those quotations out loud to my wife last night, bothering her, because I couldn't really believe what I was reading. In any event, let's talk about how the what we might call the extra scientific, that is the popular and even international nuclear disarmament movement, got started. So after roughly 1949, I guess, when the Soviets got the bomb, the cat was out of the bag. It was clear that other nations were developing nuclear weapons. How did the initial protest movement or disarmament movement after this period get started, and what did it do?
Well, actually, although the scientists were the most knowledgeable and most respected critics of the bomb right after the war, in those years, starting even in 1945-46, other groups began to get involved in the anti-nuclear campaign. But one key group, or one key movement, was the pacifist movement. There had always been substantial numbers of pacifists around the world. Their influence, of course, was shaken by the Second World War. Many were killed by the fascist powers, who didn't like pacifists in their midst at all, since they were militarists. But also they were discredited in the non-fascist powers, because they were critics of the world war or of warfare in general, and most people in the non-fascist powers viewed this war against the fascist powers as justified. So pacifism was greatly weakened by the Second World War, but nonetheless after the war began to revive. And a key point made by the pacifists was not just that atomic weapons are dangerous, but also that if war itself continues, then the danger always exists that nuclear weapons are going to be pressed into service by governments. And therefore, they argued it was war itself that had to be averted. Another key group that became involved was composed of people who rallied to the idea of world government. Now, in fact, as warfare became more and more dangerous, the general public and many government officials became conscious that something had to be done about war. The First World War, for example, led logically to the development of the League of Nations and attempt to avert a future world war. And the Second World War led to a United Nations that was designed to strengthen international institutions and, like its predecessor, the League, bring an end to war. So there were already people who were saying that international institutions had to be developed that would mediate conflicts among nation states and develop the kind of societies around the world with economic growth and social progress that would prevent future wars. But the use of the atomic bomb itself seemed to escalate the danger of war itself. And therefore, many more people now began to rally around the notion that we had to move beyond the League of Nations and the United Nations to creating an even stronger international institution, for example, a strengthened United Nations that could really control nations and stop them going off the tracks into international aggression and war. So they began to champion a world government and often said that just as in the United States, we moved from 13 independent colonies to a federal government, so we need some kind of world federation of nation states that will avert war in the same way we avert war now in the United States between New York and New Jersey. So the World Federalists were a further group that rallied around the notion that nuclear war should lead to a change in thinking, to new thinking about the world and about international conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And a further group was composed of Japanese survivors of the atomic bombing, who didn't so much blame the United States for the bombing as say, this is proof, this atomic bombing of this destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki is proof that the world is now on the brink of destruction. And we must pull it back from that brink, and we will testify to the world that this must take place. And so the Kabakusha, the Japanese survivors of the atomic bombing, began to speak out against atomic weapons and call for nuclear arms controls and disarmament.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was finally another group composed of the World Communist Movement, a movement which didn't work at all well with these other groups, and these other groups didn't work well with the communists. But the communists were very worried that the Soviet Union would be attacked by the United States as the Cold War developed. And so they became keen critics of the bomb. They were not at the outset. They actually applauded the bomb's use since they supported the Second World War. But once the war came to an end and the Cold War was on and the Soviet Union might be attacked by the United States with atomic bombs, they became keen critics of the atomic bomb and demanded the abolition of nuclear weapons. So this movement got off the ground and was a fairly effective movement in the late 1940s and provided the backdrop for the Baruch plan and for early talk by government officials of nuclear arms controls and disarmament. However, the movement declined as the Cold War developed. The reason was, two reasons were, first, that many people simply felt that in this new context of Cold War, attaining nuclear arms controls, blocking the nuclear arms race was simply hopeless. And so they backed away in frustration from the anti-nuclear campaign. But a second group was worried about the fact that criticism of the bomb was increasingly viewed by bomb-eager governments as subversive, and there were investigations of social critics, particularly those who were criticizing national defense programs. And obviously, if you got out of line in the Soviet Union and criticized the Soviet bomb program, you were in big trouble. And similarly, in the United States or in Great Britain or in other countries that either had or were developing nuclear weapons at the time, you were viewed as a marginal person and perhaps even part of what was being called the international communist conspiracy. And Senator McCarthy and other hunters of so-called un-American activities were in fact going after the early critics of the bomb and made it very difficult to continue that campaign. So it continued, but on a much reduced basis. However, hydrogen bomb testing during the early 1950s revived the movement. The hydrogen bomb, or H-bomb, as it was often called, represented a quantum leap in destructiveness. The H-bomb could be made 1,000 times as powerful as the bomb that had destroyed Hiroshima. So it meant a vastly greater area of destruction. And again, people wondered, are these bombs really protecting us? Are they simply guaranteeing our destruction in a future war? And nation states were talking about future war. The Eisenhower administration, for example, was talking about relying on a defense policy of massive retaliation, mm-hmm. meaning nuclear war at any sign of communist aggression. And furthermore, the Soviet Union was threatening nuclear war in a variety of crisis situations. And so this helped to cause a revival of the anti-nuclear movement, with many prominent figures speaking out, people like Albert Einstein and Bertrand Russell and Linus Pauling and Albert Schweitzer and so on. And to the creation of nuclear disarmament groups, groups like the National Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy in the United States, soon called simply SANE, groups like the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in Great Britain, groups like the Movement Against Nuclear Armaments in France, and so on. Movements that were particularly lively and prominent in the United States and in Western Europe, and in Australasia, and in Japan. They also began, not in movement form, but in the form of daring social critics, like Andrei Sakharov in the Soviet Union, who began to question Soviet nuclear bomb testing and actually protested at gatherings at which Khrushchev and other Soviet officials were present. So they began another great upsurge of protest, and this protest ultimately culminated in the first nuclear arms control measure in world history, the Partial Test Ban Treaty of 1963, put into place by the governments of the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union, but soon signed on to by virtually all nations around the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I guess one of the things that I find very interesting is the difficulty with which disarmament advocates, the difficulty they had making their case on a national level. Because in my experience, I can't think of any national politician who has really run on a strong disarmament platform. Have there been any, or is have I missed something? Is it just an impossible message for a national politician to send?
Well, actually not. Public sentiment, well, let me break this into two parts. The public in the United States has rather consistently has supported the atomic bombing of Japan. Of course, they didn't know about it until after it took place, but when they asked about it by pollsters, they agreed with it and continue to agree with it, according to the latest polls. On the other hand, public sentiment, as shown in polls, has also rallied against nuclear weapons. That is, there has been consistent fear and concern about nuclear weapons and a desire for treaties banning nuclear testing, for treaties that would get rid of nuclear weapons, and even for treaties that will eliminate all nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And therefore, politicians have actually campaigned for some of these arms control and disarmament measures. For example, in the 1956 presidential race, the Democratic candidate, Adlai Stevenson, spoke out for ending nuclear testing. Now, the Eisenhower administration was very upset about this, since, of course, it was conducting nuclear tests, and it didn't like this kind of criticism, so it lashed out furiously against Stevenson and so on. But nonetheless, Stevenson's call for bringing an end to nuclear tests was popular and probably helped him in his campaign. It certainly led to a strong applause at Stevenson's campaign rallies and, mm-hmm. and so on. Furthermore, in 1960, both the Republican and Democratic presidential candidates, Nixon and Kennedy, spoke out and said they were for a test ban treaty and hoped that one could be negotiated. In 1964, Lyndon Johnson sharply criticized Barry Goldwater for his talk of using nuclear weapons in the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And indeed, there was that famous Daisy ad, mm-hmm. Little girl picking petals off a daisy, and then finally nuclear bomb explodes. And she's destroyed. Mm-hmm. This ad, by the way, was made by the Democratic campaign by the same ad firm that produced the ads for SANE, the National Committee for SANE Nuclear Policy.
Really?
And Johnson, of course, won in mm-hmm. a landslide, and Goldwater was very embarrassed by his loose talk about nuclear weapons and nuclear war. Mm-hmm. Goldwater, in fact, campaigned against the partial test ban treaty of 1963 and voted against it. And that sort of thing didn't help him with the public. Mm-hmm. There have been peace candidates in various wars, I might add. They weren't necessarily anti-nuclear candidates, so usually they were. George McGovern, for example, mm-hmm. in 1972, campaigning against the Vietnam War. But McGovern was also a keen critic of nuclear weapons and wanted to move forward on the nuclear disarmament front as well. When Walter Mondale campaigned in 1984 against a very popular president, Ronald Reagan, Mondale adopted the nuclear freeze idea proposed by the Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign. Virtually all the potential Democratic candidates during the primaries endorsed the freeze as well and talked about how they were going to get rid of nuclear weapons and so on. Jimmy Carter campaigned in 1976 campaigning for an end to the nuclear arms race and indeed for getting rid of nuclear weapons. And his most important arms control and indeed foreign policy venture, he felt, was the SALT. SALT II treaty, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty number two, that he actually got signed with the Soviet government.
Mm-hmm.
So there have been all kinds of figures, including Ronald Reagan, who, although during his campaign was pro-nuclear, soon came around to an anti-nuclear stance and was making public speeches constantly saying that a nuclear war could not be won and must never be fought.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that rather than being shy about anti-nuclear views, politicians have recognized that the public wants to hear that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the latest president who has campaigned on that basis is Barack Obama, who during the campaign made a number of speeches saying that the U.S. goal should be a nuclear-free world, posting that on his website, making a major speech in Berlin on this basis, and who has spoke out in Prague in April of this year, again calling for a nuclear-free world in a way that has been very popular.
Mm-hmm. Hold on here, Larry. I got to get my foot out of my mouth. All right. Now, color me wrong. That's right.
Yeah.
I guess what I was trying to say is that it's true. I mean, what you say is absolutely correct, obviously. You're the expert. But I think what I was driving at was it's difficult for politicians to come forward and simply say we should do away with these weapons. I did in my own lifetime hear Ronald Reagan say that. He said, you know,
yes,
we have to get rid of these things. They are
no
good to anybody. And I remember that very clearly because it shocked the pants off me. maybe you could talk a little bit about, Reagan is a particularly interesting figure. And we've talked about him on the show before because, you know, he did grow up as a Cold Warrior. He was part of that generation, Nixon and Kennedy and Goldwater and Reagan. These guys were Cold Warriors. They were virulent anti-communists. They supported the development. I think they supported the development of nuclear weapons and the expansion of the nuclear arsenal. But at some point in Reagan's career, he came to believe that they simply were, as I said, no good for anybody. Could you talk a little bit about that and how he came to that opinion?
Yes, right. Well, in fact, what happened was that Reagan, certainly by the 1970s, was the hardest of hardliners. He opposed every nuclear arms control agreement negotiated by his Democratic and Republican predecessors. He felt that Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon, for example, had sold out the United States in terms of their nuclear arms control treaties with the Soviet Union. He called for a much harder line in the Cold War, for a massive military development program, including all sorts of new nuclear weapons, from the neutron bomb to the MX missile to a whole range of new nuclear weapons. And he also talked, as did his vice presidential candidate, George H.W. Bush, he talked glibly about waging nuclear war and winning nuclear wars. Reagan was certainly emblematic of the hardest of hard lines when it came to nuclear weapons. By the time he took office in 1981. However, starting in the late 1970s and cresting during the Reagan years, there was a massive anti-nuclear campaign, a revival of this earlier anti-nuclear campaign.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is the part I remember very well from my own college days. Go ahead.
Right, right. There was a massive revival of the anti-nuclear movement. Groups like the National Committee for Sane Nuclear Policy Revived grew from their very small membership by that point of 3,000 to 150,000 members. The Nuclear Weapons Freeze Campaign, another group formed during these years, grew from nothing to involving hundreds of thousands of people. The largest political demonstration in U.S. history took place in June of 1982, when nearly a million people rallied in New York City's Central Park against the nuclear arms race and called for nuclear disarmament. And polls showed that the idea of the nuclear freeze, which was supported by virtually all U.S. peace and disarmament groups, an idea that focused on bringing an end to the remaining nuclear testing that is underground, as well as development and deployment of nuclear weapons. A treaty that had to be agreed to by the United States and the Soviet Union and other governments. This nuclear freeze, polls showed, was supported by from 70 to 80% of the American public. In fact, it was on the ballot as a ballot proposition in the fall of 1982. And it had overwhelming support at that time and passed in 9 out of the 10 states where it was on the ballot, including the president's home state of California. And this kind of vast upsurge of protest, not just in the United States, but around the world, and indeed with even groups developing in the Soviet Union, groups that were harassed and repressed and people imprisoned there and so on, this massive upsurge of popular protest led to a 180-degree turnabout in Reagan's nuclear policy. Mm-hmm. He moved from being a long-term foe of arms control and disarmament to being a supporter of those. He totally turned. And I've talked to government officials at the time. I've interviewed them. And most of them were absolutely astonished by Reagan's turnabout. They couldn't understand it. They talked about how he began to fight with his own officials, telling them, well, you know, you may think that that nuclear weapons have are the only thing standing between us and Soviet domination, but how do you know that, he then said. So he simply did a dramatic turnabout and began to move forward with arms control and disarmament treaties with his Soviet counterpart. And of course, lucky for Reagan, after 1985, he was dealing with Mikhail Gorbachev, a man who was also deeply influenced by the nuclear disarmament campaign. And indeed, Gorbachev now began to talk of new thinking. The idea that the nuclear arms race had grown so dangerous that it was time to get rid of nuclear weapons, indeed to call into question war and its consequences. And he picked up this rhetoric and these ideas from the anti-nuclear campaign. So here you had two major government leaders, leaders on both sides in the Cold War, who are now suddenly calling for arms control and disarmament. And that's what followed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. And I have to say that I've been fascinated by this particular moment in Reagan's life where he has this really quite remarkable change of heart. And he had a really sort of intuitive dislike of nuclear weapons. He really didn't, he could not, as far, everything I've read suggests that he really could not understand why we should base our national defense on their existence, because he didn't think he really didn't think that killing millions of innocent people was the right thing to do. And you know what? It isn't.
I
don't either. So, but you know, that meeting at Reykjavik where they sort of start talking, and you know, it reminds me of one of these conversations that kind of gets out of hand, and they, you know, they were talking, and pretty soon they're looking at each other going, well, why don't we just get rid of all of them? And Gorbachev says, okay, let's do it. And Reagan says, okay, let's do it. And, you know, I'm just like, absolutely a moment of clarity and sense where you just really wouldn't expect it. you know, out of these
right.
two guys. It just absolutely is a shopping and kind of weirdly hopeful moment. Let me ask you this. After you know, Reagan and Gorbachev succeeded actually in signing agreements that have brought the nuclear stockpiles down and so on and so forth. Where does the nuclear disarmament movement stand today, and I say today, by the last 10 to 15 years?
Right. Well, what happened to the movement after the U.S. and Soviet governments began to get rid of nuclear weapons and to call off the Cold War is what's happened to the anti-nuclear campaign in the past. That is, people begin to get complacent, and they think, well, governments are actually moving now and solving this problem. So, you know, we can stop going to demonstrations and signing petitions and writing letters to the newspaper and to our congressmen and so on. And we can go back home and cultivate our gardens and our recipes and so on. That tends to happen, of course, to every reform movement. That is, if there are finally worker safety measures put into place and an 8-hour day put into place by the federal government and health and safety laws and minimum wage laws and maximum hour laws and so on. All these things lead to a union decline, generally speaking, because people begin to think, well, I don't have to be militant, I don't have to go out and strike, you know, the government's working for me, and the problems of exploitation are being solved. Same thing happened after the women's suffrage movement secured women the right to vote. The women's movement began to decline at that point. Of course, what happened was, after the end of the Cold War and after the nuclear stockpiles began to be reduced, and after the movement declined, governments began to say, well, you know, there's no one stopping us now from building new nuclear weapons. Let's get back on track. Let's really protect national security. And so the Indian and the Pakistani governments move forward with developing their new nuclear weapons. And the Republican-dominated U.S. Senate rejected the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty that had been negotiated by the U.S. government with the Russian government and governments around the world. And the new Bush administration, George W. Bush, began to say, well, we need new nuclear weapons, so let's develop a nuclear bunker buster and mini nukes and a reliable replacement warhead and a whole range of new nuclear weapons. So governments felt freed from the major force that had constrained them. And that force, of course, had been the nuclear disarmament campaign. But that campaign has now begun to revive as as governments not only plunged the United States and others into wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also began to talk about new nuclear weapons and new countries began to develop nuclear weapons and so on. So the movement is gradually reviving at this point. It certainly hasn't revived to the extent that it had reached during the 1980s. But nonetheless, it's out there. It blocked the Bush administration proposal for new nuclear weapons in Congress, even when Republicans control Congress. But certainly now, there seems to be no chance that the U.S. government will develop new nuclear weapons or resume nuclear testing. Thanks to this popular pressure. And indeed, the U.S. government seems to be going much further than that in terms of Obama's talking out not merely for building a nuclear-free world, but for Senate ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, the negotiation of the new nuclear arms treaty, nuclear disarmament treaty with Russia, and so on. So I think there's a revival at this point, but it certainly hasn't gotten things back to where they stood in, say, 1983 or 1984.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that there's, this will be a kind of concluding question, would you say there is, for those people who are thinking about participating in anti-nuclear activities, would you say there's any way to stop nuclear proliferation at this point? I mean, we talk a lot about Iran getting the bomb now. Joining a nuclear disarmament movement, does that help stop?
Absolutely.
Iran?
Right. Since the movement is concerned about Iran also developing nuclear weapons, about North Korea developing them, and so on. The nuclear disarmament campaign is opposed to any countries having nuclear weapons. The problem, or at least one key problem, though, in terms of proliferation is that if some countries have nuclear weapons, others feel that they have the right to have them, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty signed in 1968 and that went into force in 1970 provides that non-nuclear nations will not develop nuclear weapons, but that the nuclear nations will get rid of their nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
In short, they will all move toward a nuclear-free world together. And therefore, as long as the nuclear powers hang on to their nuclear weapons, there's not really much chance that the non-nuclear powers will forgo the opportunity of developing nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
We all have to move in the same direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it is a little bit rich when the United States says to other nations that they shouldn't develop nuclear weapons and we're sitting on a big pile of them. I mean,
United States and Russia today have 95% of the world's nuclear weapons.
Yeah, I'll admit, Larry, I'm a reasonably conservative guy, but even I see the irony there.
Right.
Yeah, so that the Iranians don't listen to us, I really am not surprised. And I would like to announce to the listeners of New Books in History that my wife and I and children have unilaterally declared our house a nuclear-free zone. So no nukes in our house. Absolutely. No nukes in our house.
Okay.
No nukes. And no throwing spoons either. So it's for myself.
All right.
So, Larry, thank you very much for being on the show. You've taken up a lot of your time. Let me conclude by asking you our traditional final question, and that is, what are you working on now? What is your next project?
Well, I'm working on my memoirs at this point, believe it or not. Since I've lived a fairly interesting life, I've been involved in all sorts of interesting movements, from the labor movement to the disarmament movement to the civil rights movement. And I thought that it was time to set some of this down for my grandchildren, as well as for the general public. And so if you know a publisher interested in publishing these memoirs, please let me know.
Oh, I'm sure that there are publishers that listen to this show that would be interested. I imagine your phone will be ringing in minutes or as soon as I put this up.
I'm sure.
I hope so. Let me tell our listeners that we've been talking to Larry Wittner about his book, Confronting the Bomb, A Short History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement. It just came out from Stanford University Press. There's a link to the book's website on the New Books in History site, so you can click through and buy the book, as I will instruct all of my students in modern warfare to do next semester, and Larry will be kicking back some of the money to me. No, obviously not. But anyway, Larry, thanks very much for being on the show. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Okay, thank you, Mark.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
You've been listening to an interview with Larry Wittner about his book, Confronting the Bomb, A Short History of the World Nuclear Disarmament Movement. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.